thou fool. Of that which thou sowest not that body that shall be, but bare grain. But God giveth it a body as it hath pleased him, and to every seed his own body. There are also celestial bodies, and bodies terrestrial, but the glory of the celestial is one and the glory of the terrestrial is another. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption, it is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory, it is sown in weakness, it is raised in power, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. Interestingly, Paul's brief sketch of the nature of the spiritual body corresponds very well with the accounts of those who have found themselves out of their bodies. In all cases, the immateriality of the spiritual body, its lack of physical substance is stressed, as are its lack of limitations. Paul says, for example, that whereas the physical body was weak and ugly, the spiritual body will be strong and beautiful. This reminds one of the account of a near-death experience in which the spiritual body seemed whole and complete even when the physical body could be seen to be mutilated, and of another in which the spiritual body seemed to be of no particular age, that is, not limited by time. Plato. The philosopher Plato, who was one of the greatest thinkers of all time, lived in Athens from 428 to 348 BC. He left us a body of thought in the form of some 22 philosophical plays or dialogues, most of which include his teacher Socrates as chief interlocutor, and a small number of letters. Plato believed strongly in the use of reason, logic, and argument in the attainment of truth and wisdom, but only up to a point. For in addition, he was a great visionary who suggested that ultimately truth can only come to one in an almost mystical experience of enlightenment and insight. He accepted that there were planes and dimensions of reality other than the sensible, physical world, and believed that the physical realm could be understood only by reference to these other, higher planes of reality. Accordingly, he was interested mainly in the incorporeal, conscious component of man, the soul, and saw the physical body only as the temporary vehicle of the soul. It is not surprising, then, that he was interested in the fate of the soul after physical death, and that several of his dialogues, especially Phaedo, Gorgias, and the Republic, deal in part with that very topic. Plato's writings are full of descriptions of death which are precisely like those which were discussed in the previous chapter. For instance, Plato defines death as the separation of the incorporeal part of a living person, the soul, from the physical part, the body. What is more, this incorporeal part of man is subject to many fewer limitations than is the physical part. Hence, Plato specifically points out that time is not an element of the realms beyond the physical, sensible world. The other realms are eternal, and, in Plato's striking phrase, what we call time is but the moving, unreal reflection of eternity. Plato discusses in various passages how the soul which has been separated from its body may meet and converse with the departed spirits of others and be guided through the transition from physical life to the next realm by guardian spirits. He mentions how some might expect to be met at the time of their death by a boat which takes them across a body of water to the other shore of their after-death existence. In Phaedo, both the dramatic setting and the thrust of the arguments and words used drive home the point that the body is the prison of the soul and that, correspondingly, death is like an escape or release from that prison. While, as we saw in the first chapter, Plato articulates, through Socrates, the ancient view of death as a sleeping and a forgetting, he does so only ultimately to disavow it and, indeed, to turn it around 180 degrees. According to Plato, the soul comes into the physical body from a higher and more divine realm of being. For him it is birth which is the sleeping and the forgetting, since the soul, in being born into the body, goes from a state of great awareness to a much less conscious one and in the meantime forgets the truths it knew while in its previous out-of-body state. Death, by implication, is an awakening and remembering. Plato remarks that the soul that has been separated from the body upon death can think and reason even more clearly than before, and that it can recognize things in their true nature far more readily. Furthermore, soon after death it faces a judgment in which a divine being displays before the soul all the things both good and bad which it has done in its life and makes the soul face them. In Book the 10th of the Republic perhaps the most striking similarity of all occurs. The Plato recounts the myth of Er, a Greek soldier. Er went away to a battle in which many Greeks were killed, and when his countrymen went to collect the bodies of their war dead his body was among them. It was lain, along with all the others, upon a funeral pyre to be burned. After some time his body revived, and Er described what he had seen in his journey to the realms beyond. First of all, Er said, his soul went out of his body, he joined with a group of other spirits, and they went to a place where there were openings or passageways apparently leading from the earth into the realms of the afterlife. Here the other souls were stopped and judged by divine beings, who could see at a glance, in some sort of display, all the things that the soul had done while in its earthly life. However, was not judged. Instead, the beings told him that he must go back to inform men in the physical world concerning what the other world was like. After seeing many other sights, Er was sent back, but he said that he was ignorant of how he was returned to his physical body. He merely woke up and found himself upon the funeral pyre. It is important to bear in mind that Plato himself warns us that he meant his descriptions of the precise details of the world the soul will enter after death to be probabilities, at best. Though he does not doubt that survival of bodily death does occur, he insists that in trying to explain the afterlife while still in our present physical life we face two strong disadvantages. First of all, our souls are imprisoned in physical bodies and are thus limited in what they can experience and learn by our physical senses. Vision, hearing, touch, taste, and smell each in its own way may fool us. Our eyes may make an enormous object seem small if it is far away, we may mishear what someone says to us, and so on. All this may result in our having false opinions or impressions of the nature of things. So, our souls cannot see reality in itself until they are liberated from the distractions and inaccuracies of the physical senses. Secondly, Plato says human language is inadequate to express the ultimate realities directly. Words conceal rather than reveal the inner natures of things. It follows that no human words can do more than indicate by analogy, through myth, and in other indirect ways the true character of that which lies beyond the physical realm. The Tibetan Book of the Dead. This remarkable work was compiled from the teachings of sages over many centuries in prehistoric Tibet and passed down through these early generations by word of mouth. It was finally written down, apparently, in the 8th century AD, but even then was hidden to keep it secret from outsiders. The form which this unusual book takes is shaped by the many interrelated uses to which it was put. First of all, the wise men who wrote it regarded dying as, in effect, a skill something which could be done either artfully or in an unbecoming manner, depending upon whether one had the requisite knowledge to do it well. So, the book was read as part of the funeral ceremony, or to the dying person during the closing moments of his life. It thus was thought to serve two functions. The first was to help the dying person keep in mind the nature of each new wondrous phenomenon as he experienced it. The second was to help those still living think positive thoughts and not hold the dying one back with their love and emotional concern, so that he could enter into the after-death planes in a proper frame of mind, released from all bodily concerns. To effect these ends, the book contains a lengthy description of the various stages through which the soul goes after physical death. The correspondence between the early stages of death which it relates and those which have been recounted to me by those who have come near to death is nothing short of fantastic. First of all, in the Tibetan account the mind or soul of the dying person departs from the body. At some time thereafter his soul enters a swoon and he finds himself in a void, not a physical void, but one which is, in effect, subject to its own kind of limits, and one in which his consciousness still exists. He may hear alarming and disturbing noises and sounds, described as roaring, thundering, and whistling noises, like the wind, and usually finds himself and his surroundings enveloped in a gray, misty illumination. He is surprised to find himself out of his physical body. He sees and hears his relatives and friends mourning over his body and preparing it for the funeral, and yet when he tries to respond to them, they neither hear nor see him. He does not yet realize that he is dead, and he is confused. He asks himself whether he is dead or not, and, when he finally realizes that he is, wonders where he should go or what he should do. A great regret comes over him, and he is depressed about his state. For a while he remains near the places with which he has been familiar while in physical life. He notices that he is still in a body called the Shining Body, which does not appear to consist of material substance. Thus, he can go through rocks, walls, and even mountains without encountering any resistance. Travel is almost instantaneous. Wherever he wishes to be, he arrives there in only a moment. His thought and perception are less limited, his mind becomes very lucid, and his senses seem more keen and more perfect and closer in nature to the divine. If he has been in physical life blind or deaf or crippled, he is surprised to find that in his shining body all his senses, as well as all the powers of his physical body, have been restored and intensified. He may encounter other beings in the same kind of body, and may meet what is called a clear or pure light. The Tibetans counsel the dying one approaching this light to try to have only love and compassion towards others. The book also describes the feelings of immense peace and contentment which the dying one experiences, and also a kind of mirror in which his entire life, all deeds both good and bad, are reflected for both him and the beings judging him to see vividly. In this situation, there can be no misrepresentation, lying about one's life is impossible. In short, even though the Tibetan Book of the Dead includes many later stages of death which none of my subjects have gone so far as to experience, it is quite obvious that there is a striking similarity between the account in this ancient manuscript and the events which have been related to me by 20th century Americans. Emanuel Swedenborg. Swedenborg, who lived from 1688 until 1772, was born in Stockholm. He was quite renowned in his day and made respectable contributions in various fields of natural science. His writings, at first oriented towards anatomy, physiology, and psychology, gained quite a bit of recognition. Later in his life, however, he underwent a religious crisis and began to tell of experiences in which he had purportedly been in communication with spiritual entities from beyond. His later works abound with vivid descriptions of what life after death is like. Again, the correlation between what he writes of some of his spiritual experiences and what those who have come back from close calls with death report is amazing. For instance, Swedenborg describes how, when the bodily functions of respiration and circulation cease, still man does not die, but is only separated from the corporeal part which was of use to him in the world. Man, when he dies, only passes from one world into another. FN2 He claims that he himself has been through the early events of death, and his head experiences out of his body. I was brought into a state of insensibility as to the bodily senses, thus almost into the state of the dying, yet the interior life with thought remaining entire, so that I perceived and retained in memory the things which occurred, and which occur to those who are resuscitated from the dead. Especially it was given to perceive that there was a drawing and pulling off mind, thus of my spirit, from the body. During this experience, he encounters beings whom he identifies as angels. They ask him, in effect, if he is prepared to die. Those angels first inquired what my thought was, whether it was like the thought of those who die, which is usually about eternal life, and that they wished to keep my mind in that thought. Yet, the communication which takes place between Swedenborg and the spirits is not of an earthly, human kind. It is instead almost a direct transfer of thoughts. Hence, there is no possibility of misunderstanding. Whereas spirits converse with each other by a universal language, every man, immediately after death, comes into this universal language, which is proper to his spirit. The speech of an angel or a spirit with man is heard as sonorously as the speech of a man with a man, yet it is not heard by others who stand near, but by himself alone. The reason is, because the speech of an angel or spirit flows first into the man's thought. The newly dead person does not realize that he is dead, for he is still in a body which resembles his physical body in several respects. The first state of man after death is similar to his state in the world, because then in like manner he is in externals. Hence, he knows no otherwise than that he is still in the world. Therefore, after they have wondered that they are in a body, and in every sense which they had in the world, they come into a desire of knowing what heaven is, and what hell is. Yet, the spiritual state is less limited. Perception, thought, and memory are more perfect, and time and space no longer pose the obstacles they do in physical life. All the faculties of spirits are in a more perfect state, as well their sensations as their thoughts and perceptions. The dying man may meet with other departed spirits whom he knew while in life. They are there to help him during his passage into the beyond. The spirit of man recently departed from the world is recognized by his friends, and by those whom he had known in the world. Wherefore they are instructed by their friends concerning the state of eternal life. His past life may be shown to him in a vision. He remembers every detail of it, and there is no possibility of his lying or concealing anything. The interior memory is such that there are inscribed in it all the particular things which man has at any time thought, spoken, and done. From his earliest infancy to extreme old age, man has with him the memory of all these things when he comes into another life, and is successively brought into all recollection of them. All that he had spoken and done are made manifest before the angels, in a light as clear as day, and there is nothing so concealed in the world that it is not manifested after death, as if seen in effigy, when the spirit is viewed in the light of heaven. Swedenborg describes too the light of the Lord which permeates the hereafter, a light of ineffable brightness which he has glimpsed himself. It is a light of truth and of understanding. So again in the writings of Swedenborg, as before in the Bible, the works of Plato, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we find striking parallels to the events of contemporary near-death experiences. The question naturally arises, though, as to whether this parallelism is really all that surprising. Some might suggest, for instance, that the authors of these various works could have influenced one another. Such an assertion could be supported in some cases, but not in others. Plato admits that he derived some of his insights partly from the religious mysticism of the East, so he might have been influenced by the same tradition which produced the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The ideas of Greek philosophy, in turn, influenced certain New Testament writers, and so it could be argued that Paul's discussion of the spiritual body has some of its roots in Plato. On the other hand, in most cases it is not easy to establish that such influence could have taken place. Each writer seems to bring up a few interesting details which also recur in my interviews, yet which he could not have gotten from earlier authors. Swedenborg read the Bible and was familiar with Plato. However, he several times alludes to the fact that someone who has just died may not realize that he is dead for some time. This fact, which comes out again and again in the narratives of those who have come very close to death, is apparently not mentioned either in the Bible or by Plato. Yet, it is emphasized in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, a work which Swedenborg could not possibly have read. Indeed, it was not even translated until 1927. Is it possible that the near-death experiences I have collected were influenced by works of the kind which I have discussed? All of the persons with whom I have talked had some exposure prior to their experiences to the Bible, and two or three knew something about the ideas of Plato. On the other hand, none were aware of the existence of such esoterica as the works of Swedenborg or the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Yet, many details which do not appear in the Bible, or even in Plato, constantly crop up in the accounts which I have gathered, and these correspond exactly with phenomena and events mentioned in the more unusual sources. It must be acknowledged that the existence of the similarities and parallels among the writings of ancient thinkers and the reports of modern Americans who survive close brushes with death remains a striking, and, so far, not definitively explicable fact. How is it, we might well ask ourselves, that the wisdom of Tibetan sages, the theology and visions of Paul, the strange insights and myths of Plato, and the spiritual revelations of Swedenborg all agree so well, both among themselves and with the narratives of contemporary individuals who have come as close as anyone alive to the state of death. FN 1 All quotations from the Bible are taken from the King James Version. FN 2 All Swedenborg quotations are taken from Compendium of the Theological and Spiritual Writings of Emanuel Swedenborg, Boston, Crosby and Nichols, 1853. Pages 160-197. 4. Questions. By now, many doubts and objections will have occurred to the reader. In the years that I have been giving talks, in private and in public, on this subject, I have been asked many questions. In general, I tend to be asked about the same things on most occasions, so I have been able to compile a list of those questions which are asked most frequently. In this chapter and the next I shall address myself to them. Are you just making all this up? No, I'm not. I very much want to pursue a career in the teaching of psychiatry and the philosophy of medicine, and attempting to perpetrate a hoax would hardly be conducive to that aim. Also, it has been my experience that anyone who makes diligent and sympathetic inquiries among his own acquaintances, friends, and relatives about the occurrence of such experiences will soon have his doubts dispelled. But aren't you being unrealistic? After all, how common are such experiences? I am the first to admit that, due to the necessarily limited nature of my sample of cases, I am unable to give a statistically significant numerical estimate of the incidence or prevalence of this phenomenon. However, I am quite willing to say this. The occurrence of such experiences is far more common than anyone who hasn't studied them would guess. I had given many public lectures on this subject, to many kinds and sizes of groups, and there has never been an instance in which someone that didn't come up afterward with a story of his own, or even, in some cases, tell it publicly. Of course, one could always say, and truly, that someone with such an experience would be more likely to come to a lecture on such a topic. Nonetheless, in many of the cases I have encountered, the person involved did not come to the lecture because of the topic. For example, I recently addressed a group of 30 persons. Two of them had near-death experiences, and both were there just because they were members of the group. Neither knew the topic of my talk beforehand. If near-death experiences are as common as you say, why isn't this fact more generally known? There seem to be several reasons why this is so. First and foremost, I think, is the fact that the temper of our times is, in general, decidedly against discussion of the possibility of survival of bodily death. We live in an age in which science and technology have made enormous strides in understanding and conquering nature. To talk about life after death seems somehow atavistic to many who perhaps feel that the idea belongs more to our superstitious past than to our scientific present. Accordingly, persons who have experiences which lie outside the realm of science as we now understand it are ridiculed. Being aware of these attitudes, persons who have transcendent experiences are usually understandably reluctant to relate them very openly. I am convinced, in fact, that an enormous mass of material lies hidden in the minds of persons who have had such experiences but who, for fear of being labeled crazy or over-imaginative, have never related them to more than one or two close friends or relatives. In addition, the general public obscurity of the topic of near-death encounters seems to stem in part from a common psychological phenomenon involving attention. A lot of what we hear and see every day goes unregistered in our conscious minds. If our attention is drawn to something in a dramatic way, however, we tend to notice it thereafter. Many a person has had the experience of learning the meaning of a new word and then seeing the word in everything he picks up to read for the next few days. The explanation is usually not that the word has just taken hold in the language and is appearing everywhere. Rather, it is that the word has been there in the things he has been reading all along, but that, not being aware of its meaning, he generally skipped over it without being consciously aware of it. Similarly, after a lecture I recently gave, I opened the floor for discussion and the doctor asking the first question said, "I have been in medicine for a long time. If these experiences are as common as you say they are, why haven't I heard of them?" Knowing that there would probably be someone there who had encountered a case or two, I immediately turned the question back to the audience. I asked, "Has anyone else here heard of anything like this?" At this point, the doctor's wife raised her hand and related the story of a very close friend of theirs. To give another example, a physician I know first became aware of experiences of this kind by reading an old newspaper article about a speech I gave. The next day, a patient gave him, unsolicited, an account of a very similar experience. The physician established that the patient could not have heard of or read about my studies. Indeed, the patient confided his story only because he was baffled and somewhat alarmed by what had happened to him and was seeking a medical opinion. It may very well have been that in both instances, the doctors involved had heard of some cases of this before, but had thought of them as individual quirks rather than as a widespread phenomenon and had not fully paid attention to them. Finally, there is an additional factor in the case of physicians which may help to account for why so many of them seem unaware of near-death phenomena, even though one would suspect that doctors, of all people, should have encountered them. In the course of their training, it is constantly pounded into M.D.S. to be that they must beware of what the patient says about the way he feels. A doctor is taught to pay close attention to the objective signs of disease processes, but to take the subjective reports, symptoms, of the patient with a grain of salt. It is very reasonable to do it this way, because one can deal more readily with what is objective. However, this attitude also has the effect of hiding near-death experiences, since very few physicians make it a practice to ask about the feelings and perceptions of patients whom they resuscitate from clinical death. Because of this attitude, I would guess that doctors who in theory should be the group most likely to uncover near-death experiences are in fact not much more likely to hear of near-death experiences than are other persons. Have you detected any differences between males and females with respect to this phenomenon? There seems to be no difference at all in the contents or types of experiences reported by males and females. I have found both males and females who have described each of the common aspects of near-death encounters which have been discussed, and there is no one element which seems to weigh either more or less heavily in male versus female reports. Still, there are differences between male and female subjects. On the whole, males who have had death experiences are far more reticent to talk about them than are females. Far more males than females have told me briefly of experiences, only to fail to respond to my letters or return my calls when I tried to follow up with a more detailed interview. Many more males than females have made remarks such as, "I tried to forget it, suppress it," often alluding to fears of ridicule, or intimating that the emotions involved in the experience were too overwhelming for them to recount. Although I cannot offer any explanation of why this should be so, apparently I am not alone in noticing it. Dr. Russell Moores, a noted psychical researcher, has told me that he and others have observed the same thing. About one-third as many men as women come to him reporting a psychical experience. Another interesting fact is that a somewhat larger number of these experiences than would be expected took place during pregnancy. Again, I can't explain why this should be. Perhaps it is only that pregnancy is in itself a rather risky physiological state in many ways, attendant with many potential medical complications. Coupled with the fact that only women get pregnant, and that women are less reticent than men to talk, this might help explain the frequency of experiences taking place during pregnancy. How do you know that all these people aren't just lying to you? It is quite easy for persons who have not listened and watched as others have related near-death experiences intellectually to entertain the hypothesis that these stories are lies. However, I find myself in a rather unique position.